Well, good morning, everybody. There's still people that are logging in, looks like. Got quite a few people. Thank you for attending our special HR forums. It was delayed a little bit while we put together some processes and put together information on a big change that's going to happen with our background check process. So let's go ahead and get started. Okay. So this is the agenda. We're going to have a little bit of a welcome, some client services announcements. We do have some staff that left and some new staff, and then we'll get into the presentations. And like I said, the background checks is going to be the big one. Compensation will cover SPET if we have time, and benefits, we'll talk a little bit about ERB again if time allows. So next slide. So as you can see, we've had quite a bit of action here in HR. And one of the things that we've been desperately working on is getting our postings and hiring done. We did have a lot of people that have left HR. Left UNM or went to other areas in UNM. So we've gotten our hiring complete. So we hope to have all of our postings and hires caught up here pretty quickly. So that's good news for all of you out in the community. So we do have Lindsay is an HR analyst, Tyra. who was in the transaction center, and she was promoted actually to an HR analyst. Elena as an HR tech. We have Judy, Natasha, Abigail, Brianna, and Nicole, who all started within the last few weeks as HR analysts, and these will be primarily doing our postings and hiring. And then Emily started down in benefits also Monday. So welcome everybody. That's what I was saying earlier. We did lose some people. Debbie Garcia, who's been with HR client services for quite a while. She went over to main campus arts and sciences. And Sri Devi, who's an analyst, she went over to HSC School of Medicine. So farewell to them, but wish them success in their new roles. And I got to mention Tyra earlier, but Nancy was in our transaction center, and Tyra, they both been promoted to HR analysts. So again, we're going to put a big emphasis on getting postings and hirings caught up. So hopefully with give us a week or two, and we should be in pretty good standing. Okay. One announcement before we get into background checks. The performance improvement policy 3215 is posted out on the university policy website. It's during the 30-day comment period. I haven't checked today to see if there's any comments, but I looked the other day, there weren't any comments. So please review those when you get opportunity. The entire process has been changed with the, Sydney puts on there no comments yet. So I don't know if that's a good sign or a bad sign. So hopefully it's a good sign. So the new policy completely changes the peer hearing process, the appeal process, goes into the hearing, the different processes we need to go through depending on the type of infractions that are found. And so you'll have the policy out there as a preamble to 3215 that talks about why the decisions were made and then why we're making changes to the policy. There's a disciplinary process for discrimination and one for non-discrimination. The discrimination area is basically anything that falls under the CEEO's purview, and anything not under their purview is what's considered non-discrimination. And then there's also documents there that outline the hearing process. So do take a look at those, give us your comments, questions, reach out to HR, and hopefully we can get those answered. All right, next slide. Okay, me again. Next slide. So background checks. We've been wanting to change our process on this for quite a while, but we just haven't been able to get these implemented. The new process will begin on September 6th, which is the day after the holiday. Don't forget next Monday, holiday, yay. I'll come back on Tuesday, and this is we'll have everything ready to go and all the new processes in place. And we'll get into some more of these, but just to highlight the changes, we are going to have increased number of staff that's going to be required background check. We're going to make changes to how the criminal conviction form is completed. We're going to have an integration with background checks done through UNM Jobs. And this will be effective for all applicants who are issued offer letters on or after September 6th. So what that means is that if you have a hiring proposal that's been sent to us prior to September 6th, and it hasn't been, you have not been issued an offer letter, then the new process will kick in. So if you submitted a hire to us today, odds are we're probably not going to be getting an offer letter by Tuesday. And so then that applicant will be required to have a background check. So we'll go into all the other stuff. So just kind of keep that in mind and feel free to jump in with questions on that. Next slide. So this new process will be for all competitive and non-competitive hiring actions that are done through UNM Jobs. And we're emphasizing here regular staff employees. So this includes all newly hired or rehired regular staff, as well as existing employees who are selected for promotion through a recruitment process. So one of the things we are not doing is going out and running a background check on all current staff. The only time a current staff will undergo a background check, if they've been selected through a promotion through either a competitive or non-competitive hiring action. So this does not include reclassifications, career ladders, transfers, anything like that. So just be anything done through a hire. Question, the background check will be required for all positions. Correct. All positions will have a background check. We actually have a slide, another question will be turnaround time for background checks. So we have a slide on that, and I'll get to that here. Probably the next slide, I think. All right, so next slide. So I think some of these questions are gonna be answered as we go through the slides. So all regular staff will require a background check. So that includes term and contract staff. So if you read the policies, regular staff does include term and contract. Regular staff does not include temporary or on call. Okay, another question, we'll get back to that. It's actually on the bottom of this slide here about the cost. But when you are doing a temporary or an on call, then the departments are going to have the responsibility to go out and review policy 3280 background checks. Section 2 of the policy outlines safety and security sensitive positions. So if you feel that you're hiring a temporary or an on-call employee that meets the criteria in Section 2 of policy 3280, then you can request a background check to be completed. And then we did add a new question in the requisition specifically for background checks on temps and on-call postings. So to answer the question about the payment is that it'll come from a university fund. So all background checks now will be paid by the university, with the exception of the three bullet points that are noted on the slide. That'll be temp and on-calls. So if your temp or on-call position meets 3280 and you want to have a background check, then those will be billed back to the department. And you will have to put in your billing information into the requisition as you currently do. And then periodic background checks to be compliant with federal or state requirements will be the department's responsibility, and anything that's related to the minors on campus requirements will be department responsibility. Okay, so what kind of background, got a question, what kind of background check will be run on regular staff hires if checks for minors on campus aren't included? So the minors on campus background check is the same as the background check we run on staff. However, the minors on campus policy may not pertain to a new hire. If a department is having a program where they are bringing in underage students, then you have to take a look at the minor on-campus policy to see if your program falls under that. And the compliance office and CEO, if you can jump in here if I'm selling this wrong, put together a new form to register your minor on-campus program. And then part of that is to have your program registered, and also then requires you to have background checks for that. So a minor on-campus background check could be separate from a hiring action. So what we're talking about here is only hiring actions. And there's also areas on campus, the research area, the animal research, who have to have periodic background checks to be compliant with federal state requirements. So they will also then have to be responsible for paying their background checks that will come from the centralized fund. Okay, so we're getting all kinds of questions here. Let's see if we can keep up. So we talked about term positions, covered the background check costs. And so we kind of talked about the regular staff hires. And I do have a slide that talks about what is covered under background checks and what a background check consists of. So Amy, so yeah, on-call requires a background check. We still require to pay for this, correct? Yes. So on-calls will require department funding for that. Another question, sending this just to me, what positions require a background check with a hire is a temporary on-call? Again, work with your HR consultant. If you have any questions, refer to 3280 background checks. Will the department receive the background check records? No. And we'll kind of get into all that a little bit later too. You'll get, we'll cover the notification part of it. So departments, so current employees would still need background checks paid for department. Well, that depends. If it's a hiring action and it's a promotion, then no, those will come from the centralized fund. If it's done through UNM jobs, and it's either non-competitive or competitive, what we call a prom C or promotion, competitive promotion or non-competitive promotion, then those will be paid for out of the centralized fund. Deanna had a question about how long it will take. We'll cover that. Gail, yes, this presentation will be saved, and I believe it's being recorded. Yeah, somebody answered that question. Felicia, why are we doing this? There's always been a big push to do background checks for all employees. We've been having some issues hiring people and finding out after the fact they have a criminal history directly related to the position that they are doing. And then we have to take actions on that. And it's just the way of the future. Background checks are becoming a standard employment process for just about every organization that's out there. So we're just getting with the times and staying current and making sure that the people we hire don't have criminal histories that are related to the position. We'll go into all that kind of stuff. Will the term employee whose position is going to be extended need a background check? No, that's not a hiring action, so no. The centralized university fund to pay for these would not include branches, correct? I believe that would be branches. Is Kevin on? He can jump in on that.
Yeah, you're correct, Mike. Covers... Like, essentially, okay. anything we're requiring, we're going to pay for. So independent of where your employee's chair is, you know, here, Gallup, HSC, California, wherever, if they fall into the bucket where we're requiring it, then the cost will be covered.
Okay, Ruth, will the candidate be notified in this requirement? Need to sign a release? If so, how that work? We will get to that. So you guys have great questions, and hopefully our slides will cover all that stuff. we'll get into the timeline processing, background checks, and the turnaround time. So, okay, next slide, please. I think we went backwards. Let's go forwards. Next one. Okay, so the standard package will be the package A that we currently have, and that is a DOJ sex offender, along with other things. I didn't list everything here, but these are the main things. DOJ sex offender, the OIG GSA, which is a requirement for all billing positions on the HSC campus. We've been rolled this into our regular background check years ago, even though those areas that don't have any Medicaid, Medicare issues, then we still do the OIG GSA on all employees. That also runs a federal and county criminal search are the main things. And then there's package B, which has everything in package A plus a motor vehicle check. So any position that requires a valid driver's license will have package B. And very rarely do we use package D, but it is used sometimes for the research labs. And so that's package A, the motor vehicle, and an education and employment verification. So as you can see, the main package is going to be A. It does not include the education and employment verification. Again, those are very rare. We do maybe 5 to 12 of those a year at best. The biggest one is package A and package B that will be used. Okay, next slide, please. So what's the impact? There's a question on the impact. So the existence of a conviction does not automatically disqualify the individual from employment. An adverse information triggers a process, not a result. So negative findings in a background check may trigger an adjudication process to determine whether the candidate's background check renders him or her from employment. And again, there are very, very detailed laws and restrictions on what we can do with a background check, what we can do with the information, what constitutes a non-hireable conviction. And then we would then be working with each case as judged on its own merit. However, the criminal conviction form will still be used. The individual must have made a truthful and comprehensive disclosure of the conviction for employment consideration. Next slide. OIG, GSA, I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly what the definition. Office Inspector General. I don't know what the GSA means right off the top of my head anymore. If somebody else wants to jump in there, then we can have that answer. There you go. Thank you, Karen. We have a lot of international researchers that have driver's license or MVD records. Well, if they don't require the driver's license, then we will not be doing the package B. And then if there's any special notes, there's still the comments section that's in the requisition form. So anything that like that, say you do hire a position that requires a license, but they're not going to be driving. So put that in the notes in the requisition or when you were hiring that person, because that may be a minimum qualification for the job. So we'll definitely have to take a look at those. But if they don't have to have a driver's license, we don't run an MVD check. Okay, back to the slides. So impact, question on faculty. This has nothing to do with faculty, this is just staff. Okay, impact. Prior to any exclusion, HR will work with OUC, and that's what we do currently. So we do run background checks now, but not on everybody, right? So if we do have that issue, we definitely work with our office, university council, to facilitate the adjudication process. And that's when we do notify the applicant of the primary finding and they give them an opportunity to respond before a final decision is made. And again, this is all by federal and state statute. We have a pre-adverse and adverse actions that we have to do. They have a right to, there's tons of rights for the applicant, the employee that we have to follow. And so then we work closely with our university council's office to make sure that the university's rights are being upheld and the applicant employee's rights are being upheld. So this slide says the results from a vendor returned in 24 to 48 hours. That's the very long end of it. Usually we get results in less than 24 hours. And a lot of this is dependent on the applicant. So what happens, the process is when we submit for a background check, the applicant or the employee now will get an email from Sterling, our background check vendor. Click here, give us this information, and they run the background check. The one I did the other day, the applicant was right on top of it, filled the requisition out or filled the information out within like 20 minutes of me sending it, and I got the results back within the hour. So the whole process took less than 2 hours to get the results back. And this is where, as a department, when you are talking to your final candidate, you need to inform them that you're going to get emails from HR and or Sterling, and that they need to be on top of these things immediately, because that is oftentimes the delay is the applicant filling out the information from Sterling. It's the applicant filling out the demographic information and getting us back the information that we have to have in order to process the hire. So the faster that they stay and monitor their emails and stay on top of the requirements and the act on the emails and the information that we need to get, then the faster it's going to happen. 48 hours is, I very rarely see anything taking 48 hours, and I very rarely see anything taking 24 hours. It's usually same day turnaround within an hour to 6 hours. Okay, we'll get into the offer letters here. Will the background check requirement info be on posting requisitions? Yes. We are going to put some language that is going to be on the posting that states a background check is required. But that's also on the affidavit that is filled out as part of the hiring process or the application process, I should say. Anybody that fills out an application currently fills out the affidavit that says, I agree to be truthful on my all my information. I understand that a background check may be required. So all of that is already on the affidavit part of the application process. So we're good there, but we're also going to have that on the postings, kind of on the bottom where it talks about all the other information, the COVID information that's going to be added down to that. Are we still a rehabilitative employer? Absolutely. Absolutely. That is part of New Mexico state law as being a rehabilitative employer. So absolutely, we follow all the regulations. Rob, background checks required for all types of faculty. You know, faculty is not covered by this. If you have any questions on any faculty issues, I saw Emily on earlier. She can jump in here if she needs to, but this does not involve any faculty. Possibility background checks being required for student employees. Not that I know of at this time. Again, that's up to student employment. Again, this is just staff. The adjudication process timeline, that could take a while. And then we would definitely be working with the department on what that adjudication process is, because that could involve the applicant working with the background check company to dispute any findings that they had. It could be an identity theft issue, it could be that. So there really isn't the timeline for that, but we'll definitely work with you on any adjudication processes. But don't be too worried about the adjudication process. And we've been doing background checks since I've been here for 16 years. And the people that haven't been hired through an adjudication process is like 2 or 3 or 4 people. We very rarely have any issues. Yeah, we are going to be doing more background checks, so that does increase the possibility of adjudication. But I don't really see that that's going to be a major stumbling block. If history is a predictor of what we're going to be seeing in the future, but so Will we need to repost current regs to include the language? No, Amy, no, you don't have to repost anything. Again, like I said, because that's part of the affidavit that's filled out during the application process. So, boy, a lot more questions than I thought. Okay, next slide.
Sam, did we cover this slide?
Yes.
Okay, we did. Sorry, I thought I might have jumped it. There's the next slide.
Okay, so I got another email just to me. Previous year's email from Sterling would go to junk spam folder, causing some delays, but working with the candidate to verify they actually filled out the demographic form and submitted makes a difference. Thank you for that. We can definitely check with Sterling, because with the integration on where that email is going to come from, if it's going to be UNM jobs based or if it's still going to be, I think it's going to still be Sterling based, but we can check into that. We'll get into the position specific list here shortly. That's another slide we have. So good, we anticipated all the questions. So hopefully we got everything covered. So ultimately this is not going to slow down the hiring process. We are going to issue an offer letter while the background check is pending. And we have changed the language in the offer letter. So this is just cut and paste from the new language from the offer letter that says that we have employment is conditioned upon the following. It's not just a background check. We also have listed in there the COVID requirements. And I think we also have a bullet point discussing the if it's a need for pre-employment exam, physical exam. So those are covered in the offer letter too. But what I have cut and paste here is just about the pre-employment part. So passing a pre-employment background check. Your pre-employment background check may include an element to a criminal history background check, New Mexico Department of Health fingerprint screening, CYFD fingerprint screening, verification education credentials, and or verification of prior employment. So we just lumped everything in there. So that doesn't mean that every applicant's going to have to be fingerprinted. Every applicant's going to have verification of prior employment. If your position requires these things to be done, then you have to successfully pass all of those things in order to start your employment. And then we have the right to rescind this offer of employment if those conditions aren't met. So a question again, we have an applicant coming from out of state. How will his background check be checked? Same way. And it depends, the length of time it takes to do a background check is based on the applicant, right? So a background check usually does a history, address history check that goes back 7 to 10 years. So if you have an applicant that's lived in 7 states over 7 years, then yes, that background check is going to take a little bit longer to process. And there are some states that, based on their state rules and laws and regs, that they don't release certain information. Nevada is one of those that doesn't release sex offender information. So applicants coming from like Nevada do take a little bit longer. There's some states out on the West Coast or East Coast that take a little bit longer due to their state rules and regs on releasing criminal history information. So it depends on what state they're coming from, then that might delay everything getting done. Another question, 3280 says, one consideration in terms of background check is a requirement of a license, certification, or degree. So if we hire a temp on call with a title that requires a bachelor's degree as a minimum, they'll require a good background check. Not necessarily if it's just a college degree. We can verify those through National Student Clearinghouse. We can verify licenses and certifications through the licensing agencies like RNs. Departments can go look at the nursing certification websites and confirm licenses and certifications. So there's other things that we do currently to validate license and certifications and college education that don't involve background checks, and those processes aren't going to change. Okay, next question. Next slide, please. Okay, criminal conviction form will no longer be completed at the department level. We have added that to the onboarding document. So again, this is when you talk to your applicant to make sure that they are one, that they know they're going to get an email from Sterling that they need to complete the information to get the background check going. You need to let your applicant know that they need to complete the onboarding documents that are sent by HR, because now that's been included with the onboarding. And the onboarding documents will now be the criminal conviction form. That'll be the employee demographic form where they provide us their date of birth, their social security number, their addresses and stuff that we use to get them a person record and banner, excuse me, along with some other acknowledgement forms, a benefits acknowledgement and some other documents that are part of the onboarding. So now this will be part of that. And so now HR will notify the department if the criminal conviction form and or background check information results in an applicant that may be denied or go through the adjudication process. So if everything is good, we're not going to inform the department. Before, where we set the department, which was kind of silly on our part, we've been trying to change this for the longest time. But the current process is we run the background check, we get the results, we send you the results that say, hey, this person's passed. Now you have to reattach that to UNM Jobs to tell us that you've received notification. All that's going away. Everything is going to be handled internally to HR, the criminal conviction form, the background check. So you'll just know that it's been done. The only time you'll hear from us is if there's a problem, right? So if it leads to the adjudication process, or if it's going to delay the hire because we have to start the adjudication process, then we will notify the department. We'll work with you. We'll work with the applicant to see what that looks like and get that taken care of. And so the criminal conviction form will be removed from the HR forms webpage. So that doesn't mean to go out there now and print off 100 copies of that so you have them in reserve to give them out. You will no longer be needing the criminal conviction form. And as of today, if you have a hiring that you're getting ready to submit today through the 6th, don't have them fill out the criminal conviction form, because we will have that as part of the onboarding on the 6th. Now, if your hire is going to happen, if you're going to submit it today and we have to rush a hire for Friday, that's a whole different story. But I don't know if anything's going to happen before Friday if you got to rush hire. So a question about, I'm interviewing someone next week, September 7th. I do not need to collect a CCC form. That is correct. If you wait till the 7th to download the CCC form, you will not find it on our webpage. That's going to be removed. So, well, good. Thank you. I hope you like that one. The criminal conviction form is going to be removed from the forms webpage. Okay, next slide. So currently, as I stated before, we are working with Sterling BackCheck as our current vendor, and it's going to be integrated within UNM Jobs. And so I kind of covered this. Departments will no longer be required to attach confirmation of background checks in UNM Jobs. Even if it's a temp or on-call hire and the department is running a background check for that, HR will still own the process and departments will not be required to attach any documentation, criminal conviction form, confirmation of a background check, anything. We will own that whole process. Again, departments will only be notified if HR starts the pre-adverse action process. And applicants will not be hired if we start the pre-adverse action process. Now, that's different than just looking at it, determining whether or not we're going to start the pre-adverse. But once we start the pre-adverse action, then the hire is going to be put on hold until we get all that sorted out. And again, we've had a handful of these in 16 years of doing background checks. Okay, let's get caught up on some questions. We submitted our hiring proposal and received the initial email saying it was approved. If I understand correctly, the selected applicant will receive a Sterling email before the offer is sent, correct? We'll have to take a look at that to see where that in the process, Laura. So if you can send me or send your consultant the posting, the requisition number, and we can look and see exactly where it is in the status and if that hire will need, will fall under the old process or new process. Is the posting form on UNM Jobs going to be modified to have the background check box removed? Yes. Yes and no. So the current question is going to be modified to say, does your on-call or temporary position require a background check? Yes or no. And so the only time you'll have to answer that question is if it's a temp or on-call, if your position meets the requirements in 3280. So talk with your HR consultant, and then we can work through that. And so again, remember, if it's a temp or on-call hire, then that will be billed back to the department. Will the required document section and staff justification memo need to be updated? Angel, you're brilliant. I did not think about updating that form. So yes, we will update the requisition form to include that, trying to brainstorm everything, change everything in the confluence with the instructions and everything. I did not look at that. So thank you very much for that. We will have to update the memo. All right, next slide. So I'll make a note of that right now to take to update the justification form. And if anybody else sees anything out there that needs to be fixed that we didn't think of, then please let us know. Okay. There is, and we did with this a little while ago, we created the client services webpage that has the HR recruitment hiring services request form. We covered that in probably the last form, I think. But if you need the background check to be compliant with the minors on campus policy or other legal requirements, that is the form that you would fill out to send us, to notify us that we need to do a background check. So the current form that's out there, the background check request form, is going away. That whole page is being redone. The position-specific background check language is being taken out. The position-specific request form is going away. The position-specific spreadsheet is going away. So there's major changes happening on that. But if you do need to request a background check for compliance with minors on campus or other legal requirements, then you would go to the recruitment and hiring services request form and click background check. And all the information from the old form has been put in the SmartSheet form. And you'll use that to request a background check, other than for a hire. Okay, next slide. Kind of covered that already. We're no longer utilize the position department specific background check process, and all of that information is being removed. Will no longer be, departments will no longer be required to justify a department-specific background check, because all positions across the university for staff will be required to have a background check. Next slide, please. So this does not impact the background check process for the HSC credentialing office or for student employment. You'll continue to follow the processes established by those areas. Okay, next slide, please. Hey, that's it, finally. Any other questions that we didn't cover so far? Silence. Good. Hopefully we covered everything. Again, if you have any questions, reach out to me directly. There's my email address. Reach out to your HR consultant. And we are going to be working very closely with the Transaction Center, our new analysts, to get this process up and get them trained here before the end of this week on what that looks like. And we'll see when the integration is actually going to be finalized. We have another meeting with the vendor Friday to do a walkthrough, hopefully on a mock setup for the integration. So hopefully we're going to have that up and running here shortly. But again, thank you for your patience and cooperation as we get through this new process. There are going to be questions on hires that are currently submitted, whether or not you meet the old process or the new process. Don't hesitate to reach out to us, but give us the rec number so we can take a look at it, and that we can respond back to you with the most current information on the status of your current hire. Thank you. We have a few minutes left, so hopefully we can get through SPET and ERB stuff. I am actually going to check out right now. I have to jump on another meeting, but Kathy, this AVP is on, and again, send me any emails that you have on anything. So thank you. Catherine, it's all yours.
Thanks, Mike. So I am going to be giving just a brief sort of orientation to the introduction of the Salary Placement and Equity Tool, known as the SPET, implementation plan. So it is a three-part plan, as you see up there on the screen. So the first has to do with UAP 3500, which is the Wage and Salary Administration updates. So we are working on updating UAP 3500. After extensive review, proposed revisions have been made to better align UAP with anticipated changes to pay practices. Those revisions are currently pending Policy Review Committee or PRC review. And we anticipate that UAP 3500 proposed revisions will go out for public comment and union discussions in early fall, but those are just pending right now. The second sort of leg of that SPET implementation plan is the communication plan, which is going to happen mostly through weekly emails or bulletins. So the bulletins will function as a guide for staff that are going to be using the SPET. So on how to use it, orienting to some of the changes within UAP 3500 once approved, and sort of just an overall of how things are going to work moving forward with the SPET. It will be sent to UNM jobs users as well as HR agents, and it's designed to be a reference guide for those groups. The third piece of that of the plan is that we're actively working to develop training dates and events. We are working to establish not only the dates, but also how those trainings will be. We're hoping for a blended approach so that we have some stuff live in person, probably via Zoom, but then also some recorded resources and historical references that people can go back to. As soon as we have that information finalized, we'll be sharing that with all of y'all as well. So the goal remains to implement SPET in the late fall of this year. But with that said, there are many dependencies that determine the final rollout timeline. I don't know about y'all, but I'm not very good at predicting the future. So we just gotta wait and see how it all develops. What we can say though, is that information will continue to be shared throughout the implementation process as soon as we have it. And that if you have any questions, continue to contact anyone within the HR compensation unit to discuss any questions that you might have about this.
All right. Okay, thank you, Catherine. So any questions for Catherine? Any questions that somebody thought of later and now would like to ask on background checks? See some nodding heads, so I think we're good. Let's go to the next slide. All right, Joey, are you out there?
I'm here.
All right, got the last 10 minutes or so.
All right. Well, I will rock and roll through this as fast as possible. I just wanted to give everybody a little bit of clarification on the ERB return to work requirements. And basically, you know, what this is anyone who retires under the ERB plan, or also who is an alternative retirement plan retiree and desires to return to work without suspending their pension, has four opportunities or four methods for returning to work. And the thing about this is, you know, the legislative sessions over the last 4 years have actually added different provisions each year. You know, I don't think we had any changes to return to work for, I don't know, 15 years. And then all of a sudden the last four, we've had changes every year. So I think it's resulted in a little bit of confusion. And so I wanted to just briefly hit on what each of these are. So, you know, there's four methods to return to work. You have the 0.25 or less, which I think we're all familiar with, which basically you can return to work with no layout and not have your pension suspended as long as you work only 0.25 FTE or less. If you work more than that, then you would have to have a layout period or you would have to suspend your pension. I'm going to get into some administrative processes on the 0.25 in just a second. Then there is also the 90-day layout provision where you're restricted to $15,000 a year in salary. The provision around laying out 90 days also requires you do not have a formal or informal agreement with your employer to return to work. So once you lay out and do not render service for 90 days, you can return and be limited to work as much as you want and be limited to $15,000 a year. The next provision was added this past year. It was actually effective May 18th, I believe. And that is where you can lay out for 90 days and return to work unrestricted. You can work as much as you want and earn as much as you want, but you're restricted to working for 36 consecutive or non-consecutive months. So kind of think of this 90-day and 36-month restriction as taking the place of, if you will, the 12-month layout return to work provision where you can lay out, and that's been around since early 2000s, where you can lay out for 12 months and return to work unrestricted, work as much as you want and earn as much as you want. That provision per statute currently sunsets December 31 of 2023. So that's why I say, I think you kind of think of the 90-day layout and 36-month restriction as sort of replacing that. The thing that's important to note is any method for returning to work and not having to suspend your pension requires that the ERB approves that return to work application before somebody begins working. So that means that if someone wants to return under any of these provisions, they have to submit the return to work application to the ERB and receive the letter basically saying, yes, you can return to work under this provision before they actually start their job. It is the retiree's risk of having their pension suspended if they do not follow the requirements to apply to the return to work program. I mean, as an employer, if we're bringing back someone who's retired under the ERB, you know, I think that we would want to make sure that they're aware that they could be at risk of suspending their pension if they do not adhere to the requirements. Last, I want to quickly talk about the 0.25 FTE administrative process. I'm going to answer your question in just a second, April. So under the provision for returning to work and being limited to 0.25 FTE, an individual still has to apply. There is not technically a layout period, but the individual has to be retired for one day before the ERB will actually process that return to work. In addition to that, the individual has to have been, their retirement basically has to have been finalized such that the ERB has them set up on their payroll before they will approve the return to work application under the 0.25 ERB. So to make that kind of a practical example, if somebody retires June 30th, or you know their last day of work is June 30th, so they're a July 1 retiree, the ERB will not consider their return to work application until after July 1st. And then it takes the ERB 7 to 10 business days to process that application. One fortunate thing is the return to work application for the ERB is now in DocuSign, so it's a little bit more efficient than the retiree having to mail it to the ERB and all those kind of things. So they can use a DocuSign process. Once the ERB approves it, then the individual can basically begin their job. So there had been a lot of questions around, well, do you have to wait 30 days for the 0.25, et cetera? No, there's technically not a layout period required, but there is an administrative process that the ERB uses that, you know, results in somebody not being able to, you know, their last day of work to be June 30th and return to work on July 1st and start working. It's going to be probably a couple of weeks into July before they're actually able to start their job under that 0.25. I'm going to read your question real quick, April. Yeah, I had mentioned that earlier, that this is both ERB and ARP retirees. So April, can someone work the 36 months and lay out 90 days again and work? No. On the 36 month, you are restricted lifetime under current statute, restricted for lifetime after you've worked that 36 months. You could do the 90 day layout, work your 36 months. And my understanding is after that, you could then, you know, do the 0.25 restriction. You know, you would have to submit another application to the ERB for that specific return to work provision. The other thing is there's a link in these slides that I strongly recommend you go to. The ERB has made some updated communications around return to work, and they've put a comparison table out there that shows, you know, again, all four provisions for return to work require an application. It shows the, you know, under what provisions do employees and the employer have to make non-refundable contributions to the pension fund? What provisions do they not make contributions, et cetera. So I strongly recommend that you go and take a look at the table if you have further questions. And of course, if you have additional questions about return to work, please don't hesitate to contact anyone in benefits. I just wanted to make sure that it's understood, most importantly, that the retiree is at risk if they don't follow the process to apply for the return to work program and be approved prior to starting work. And so I think it's very important that we recognize that if we are hiring a return to work retiree. Any Joe, questions?
Joe, go ahead. Can I add one more thought?
Sure, of course.
So for all departments who have folks that they are going to hire in a return to work category, one of these, if it happens to be that you're going to hire someone back into a position that happens to be benefit eligible, please, please advise that return to work retiree who's now working in a benefit eligible position to contact the benefits office. We need to speak with them regarding their retiree benefits if they happen to have enrolled, because not everybody does as a retiree, in any medical, dental, or life insurance. We need to talk through what they need to do, because they are being rehired in a benefit eligible position again. They kind of need to be moving on to our UNM benefits, they pay into VEBA again. There's a lot of little nuances. We're working on some communications to post on our website around that, but please have them reach out to the benefits office so we can talk through how that affects their benefits. Joey, do you have anything to add to that? I kind of rushed through that.
No, other than that, yes, we are working on ensuring we have some information on the website to provide further instruction about the UNM requirements when someone returns to work. All right, that's it for me. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we are at time. We have about 3 minutes left. If anybody has any other questions or general questions or that we can answer quickly, maybe.
I have a question.
Okay.
I find it very difficult when people retire and they've been gone from the university for 10 years and they're now my employee, they're on call, whatever. And they're still under their org for their original. Is there salary redistributions or EPAS or anything like that? I don't have to try to contact somebody in a department who doesn't even remember who this person is.
So, Joey, I know what that problem is. The problem is on the PEMPL record, right? Because the PEMPL record remains their retirement record. And then when they go to insert a new EPAP or do a hiring action, even on our vital airs, they show up. And then we have to go in and figure out where their job is located versus. And I'm wondering if that's some of the setup on some of the reports that we have, same similar to our vital airs report or our active employee report, if we're pointing to the wrong area to obtain that information.
Yeah, that's the other problem is they don't show up on my active employee report.
Well, because they're on somebody else's org, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Let me just say this. That is a recognized problem. And I will add it to our to-do list because I do think there are probably some fairly easy ways that we can help resolve this, maybe. Or it's far more complex than I think it is. And but let's look into it.
Okay. Thank you.
Alrighty. Thank you.
Joey, I see a question in the chat.
Alan, I was wondering if you could clarify. I'm not exactly sure what you mean. I mean, there's a bunch of scenarios in which someone would not elect benefits. Are you talking about if they are a return to work retiree in a benefits eligible position?
What I'm talking about is some people that we currently hire are those that are probably from the government, and they already have their benefits already given to them. And what we're just wondering if there was actually like a role or a different way of doing this as they're not electing to have benefits. Is there a way that we can actually hire them and they don't have to be a part of the Education Retirement Board, but they have been working with the Education Retirement Board before, but they elect not to have benefits taken or to be put back into the Education Retirement
Board. Got it. So if they, you know, from a standpoint, if they are not, so for example, if they're a para, a public employee retirement association retiree, then they come to work for an ERB employer, they're not going to contribute or gain service credit under the ERB. Outside of those types of scenarios, there is not any type of statutory exclusion for individuals who you know, maybe don't even care that they're going to, let's say you retired from the federal government and then came to work for UNM, you're going to have to contribute to the ERB because off the top of my head, I don't think that there is an exclusion for federal government retirees to not have to participate in the ERB. So, you know, you know, basically the bottom line is if they contribute to the ERB and then they decide to leave without being eligible for a conditioned retirement, then they're going to be able to roll over their contributions and interest earned into another qualified retirement account or take a withdrawal of that. So there's really not, I mean, from a statutory perspective, there's not classes that we can exclude based on, I think, based on what I understand your question to be.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm asking.
Okay.
I didn't know if there was a way to actually look that up.
Got it.
There was a way that we could do that because I know some of the people that we've actually are try to hire, we try to do them as a consultant, as they typically do not need the benefits as they're full benefits eligible from AFRL or whatnot. So I just wanted to know if there was anything else in that line of work that we can actually be able to save on fringe benefits and whatnot on fringe. And that way they're not elected into these actual items or in these classes. So.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. Oh, thank you so much.
Sure.
All right. We're a little over time. Any other questions? All right. Happy Tuesday, everybody, and enjoy the holiday weekend. Hopefully we're all doing something fun.
You too, Kathy. Thank you.
Have a great week, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Steve, are you there still?
Yeah, still here. Still.
All right.
So, didn't want to kill it in case somebody had a very last minute question. So
yeah, hanging in there. All right. No, I thought those were great questions.
No, yeah, really, really good feedback from everyone, and yeah, I mean, it worked. I think it worked out really well, and was kept within time, which I think is good, very positive.
Yeah, that was good. Okay. All right. Well, if you want to go ahead and end the meeting.
And all right. See you later.
All righty. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
Yep.